Hey, this is Swoopy, and you're listening to Skepticality for Tuesday, June 28th, 2005.
Skepticality, truth in podcasting.
Hey, this is Derek, and over there to my right is Swoopy. This is Skepticality, episode number 10.
Woo!
Tonight, we have a very special guest, Mr. James Randi himself.
The amazing Randi.
The amazing Randi. He took some time out of his day to get on the phone with us for about 30 minutes, and we're going to play that part of that interview later on at the last half of our show, so you got to stick around for that.
We've been doing a lot of interviews lately.
We've had so many great interviews.
We even did a newspaper interview.
Actually, we had the AJC, which is the local newspaper here in Atlanta, actually come into Batpig Studios, and they took pictures and talked to us for a couple hours about our podcast and podcasting in general. And that article is actually going to be page one news, believe it or not. So we'll see how well they treated us. Maybe they'll talk about how terrible we are. So we've actually had some great guests, the editor of Free Inquiry, Tom Flynn, and another editor, Benjamin Radford, who is one of the editors for Skeptical Inquirer, and he's an author and has a wonderful book called Media Mythmakers.
It's a good book.
And we also had Phil Plait on from
way back when.
Way back.
He was our first interview.
He was our first interview with Bad Astronomy. Go to badastronomy.com and check out Phil Plait's stuff. If you haven't heard our past interview shows, you probably should go back and grab some of those from our website. That's www.skepticality.com.
Good thing people like them because there's more.
Because there's more. Actually, yeah. I mean, tonight we have James Randi, and it doesn't stop there. We end up with Dr. Michael Shermer later on in the week,
wow,
who is the editor of Skeptic Magazine, www.skeptic.com. And we also have a book author, Jennifer Michael
Hecht,
who is the author of Doubt, which is a really great book. And you can look that up on Amazon, or you can look up her website by Googling her. Yeah, we're pretty sure that her last name is Hecht.
Beautifully purple.
You have very big hair envy for Jennifer's purple hair, don't you?
A little bit.
You tried to do some purple hair earlier this year.
It was when we were in Hawaii.
It was when we were in Hawaii. You tried to do some purple hair.
Didn't work out.
And you were very crestfallen that your purple hair did not work.
Let's not talk about it. A Romanian university has slapped a sex tax on students, inviting their partners to spend the night with them in dormitories. Yes, the Alexandru Ion Cuza University in Lasi charges £4 each time, that's the British pound, each time a boyfriend of a girlfriend spends the night with one of the 1,800 people living on campus. That's probably a good policy. One dormitory manager said if they want to spend the night with their girlfriends or boyfriends, then they should pay. This is not their home, and it is not such a high price to pay. He added that hundreds have already paid the charge, with male students particularly keen to pay and saving the receipts to show to friends. The university hopes to raise about $50,000 a year, which will go toward repairs at the dormitories. $50,000 a year, it's almost like a brothel. Malaysian lawmakers to learn snake hunting. In Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, they report the head of a Malaysian state government has ordered his coalition's legislatures to learn how to catch snakes so they can help people in distress. This is not the first time Syed Razak Syed Zain, he's got a really groovy name, the chief minister of Kedah State, has issued down-to-earth orders. He has made it mandatory for the ruling Barisan National Coalition lawmakers to learn paramedic skills, to perfect land and water rescue techniques, to eat healthy food and stay fit. He says elected representatives must pass the acid test of being able to help people in distress, including knowing how to catch snakes, perform first aid, and carry out rescue missions. He has made it mandatory for the Barisan assemblymen to join the civil defense force to acquire such skills. I don't know. I could see our lawmakers doing that. Snake catching, helping people. Do like Baywatch with like senators. I don't know how many of them we'd want to see running down the beach, but you know, whatever. Are you shy? Are you uncomfortable at parties? Short junk DNA may be to blame. A new animal study suggests differences in the length of seemingly non-functional DNA, known as microsatellite or junk DNA, may explain why some people are outgoing and others not so much. The findings may also help scientists better understand human social behavior, including disorders such as autism, which is very cool. The study conducted by investigators at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center of Emory University, that's our closest link to monkey news this time around, and the Center for Behavioral Neuroscience in Atlanta, hey, local people, appears in the current issue of the Journal of Science. Researchers bred two groups of prairie voles, which are like little moly rodent things, you know, with the pointy snoots. And they bred them with short and long versions of junk DNA and compared the male offspring after they matured. They found the length of junk DNA affected gene expression patterns in the brain. The male prairie voles with long junk DNA had higher levels of vasopressin receptors in brain areas involved in social behavior and parental care. Previous research showed that the vasopressin receptor gene regulates social behavior in many species. So the ones with longer junk DNA would approach strange voles more quickly, spent more time investigating social odors. Yes, odors. Like, they investigated the smells. And they were more likely to form bonds with mates. And they also spent more time nurturing their offspring than males with short junk DNA. So, I've obviously got some short junk DNA going on. And you got, like, the longer junk DNA going on. Because I'm shy.
You mean me?
You're not shy.
Yeah. So that means I have long junk DNA?
Yeah.
Is that kind of like a weird DNA insult?
Depends.
I mean, does it have to be called junk DNA?
Well, no, it's actually called microsatellite DNA. But it's junk because it doesn't do nothing.
Except make you outgoing.
Apparently. They're figuring it out.
So we're going to keep this little segment short before we get on with James Randi's interview, which is going to be right after our next break. We've had a lot of great feedback here at Skepticality, and we wanted to keep making sure that people know that we're out there listening. We've had some really good emails from people like Rachel from over at the Penn & Teller Bullshit Forums. And then we've also had some really great communications back and forth on the message board. One of our posters by the name of Hiev pointed out that I might be a little bit incorrect on one of the flat earth comments that I made.
I think it was a misconception of...
Yeah, I stated that Atlas, all the way back throughout time, has always carried the world on his back in that globe, not a pancake. When I was trying to explain the fact that the concept of a spherical Earth was well known all throughout history, and I tried to point out that, you know, even Atlas doesn't carry a pancake on his back. But he had pointed out that the actual legend and mythos of Atlas isn't that he carries the world on his back. He carries the heavens and the sky and the bulk of the heavenly bodies on his back.
But it's round.
But yeah, it is actually in spherical form. All the way back into the BC era, there's even statues from the BC era that show Atlas carrying a globe. But, I mean, it's a globe made up of heavenly bodies. There's, like, astrological signs in the globe and so on and so forth. So
we don't talk about astrology. Well, maybe on Whimsicality we do, but not yet.
We can talk about astrology when it's in a sculpture from the BC era, though.
Okay. But we do have a really nice voicemail that somebody left. Can I play it?
Yeah, sure.
Hi, this is Chris from Cleveland, Ohio. I discovered you guys on the Sci-Fi Podcast Network, and I gotta say, I'm absolutely loving the first show I've heard. It's number 9, and I'm really enjoying it. So I'm gonna go back and download the rest of your guys' stuff and pass you folks around to some friends. All right, thanks for all the good work. I'm looking forward to future episodes. Take care. Bye bye.
He's gonna pass us around to his friends.
Well, you know, he pointed out something that I don't think has been addressed on our show yet. Between our last show and this show, we were put up on the Sci-Fi Podcast Network, and we are not necessarily a science fiction podcast.
Well, so that's flattering.
So it's very flattering, and we actually got an email from the administrator of the Sci-Fi Podcast Network. He wanted to get our show up because he actually himself is the organizer of one of the Arizona skeptical associations. I believe it's in Phoenix, or it might be just all of Arizona. And he wanted us to put our podcast up on the Sci-Fi Podcast Network because in science fiction, there's a lot of people that see things that go on in science fiction and fantasy, because I think there's also fantasy on the Sci-Fi Podcast Network as well. And he wanted to make sure there's a couple shows up there that dealt with issues other than the fantasy aspect, so that maybe we'd have, when we have people like Phil Plait on, we talked a little bit about, you know, some of the realities of physics in movies. We talked a little bit about Star Wars and things like that. So we actually do touch on, you know, debunking pop culture that goes on. And a lot of people are led to believe things when they see them in movies. He thought it would be interesting to have our show up there as kind of a counterbalance to the fiction that shows that were out there. And I took that as a huge compliment. So anyway, let's take a break. And when we come back, you will be introduced to Mr. James Randi and his interview with Skepticality.
Good morning, class. My name is Dr. Neville Johansson Steinches. Welcome to Geek Sexuality 101. For the next semester, we shall be studying the nuances and subtleties of geek sexuality. Yes, I realize that many of you are skeptical of the entire concept of geek sexuality and view it perhaps like it was some fairy tale of olden times. But I suggest to you that geek sexuality is alive and well, and the species is in no danger of dying out, as anyone could plainly say at the recent Revenge of the Sith showing. They seem to be breeding at prolific rates, no? Now, since this is our first class together, I thought I'd start things out slowly as to not overload your delicate senses on your first day. I present to you a short audio clip entitled Eugene's First Time. Now, if you'll all open your books to page 194, we'll examine something which is likely unknown to most of you, the female genitalia structure. Those of you with used books, take extra precautions as the pages are likely stuck together.
Michael and Evo's Dragon Page, winging it. Two dorks who aren't afraid to make fun of even bigger dorks, if given just cause, which happens every week. Subscribe to Wingin' It or one of their other weekly podcasts at
www.dragonpage.com.
Recorded from deep inside the den of truth, hidden somewhere in Batpig Studios, you're listening to Skepticality with Derek and Swoopy.
Perhaps nobody in the world understands both the virtues and the failings of the paranormal as well as Randi does. His qualifications as a rational human being are unparalleled. That's a quote from Isaac Asimov speaking about our guest today, Mr. James Randi. One of America's most original and fearless thinkers, Mr. Randi has been recognized internationally for his tireless and successful investigations of psychic, supernatural, and magical claims dealing with subjects that border on both science and mythology. He is a regularly requested speaker, having lectured at such places as the White House, Cornell University, Harvard, MIT, Oxford, Princeton, Stanford, and Yale, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Mensa, NASA, the National Geographic Society, the National Science Foundation, and the Smithsonian Institution, and now, can you believe it, Skepticality. Pardon us if we're a little starstruck today in welcoming Mr. James Randi to the show. Good afternoon from sunny Florida.
Well, thank you.
How was the weather
today?
It
is sunny today. We've had a lot of rain lately. It's really been bad. I'm looking at the windows, and I see some actual radiation falling on my Venetian blinds, so it must have stopped raining at least for a few minutes.
Oh.
It's been like that up here in Atlanta as well. It's rain, then sun, then rain again, and it's been really bad lately.
Well, we like to feel that you send it down here to us, you see.
We don't have the nice water, though, so we don't get the other benefit.
Oh, okay.
So, James, why don't you tell the folks that listen to the show a little bit about the James Randi Educational Foundation?
Funny you should ask. Yes, the foundation has been in existence for umpteen years now. I'm very bad on years, having had so many of them myself. I lose track of them. But we've been here in Fort Lauderdale since we were first initiated. We got organized, as a matter of fact, because a very wealthy gentleman who will remain nameless, and that's the way he wants it, gave us a substantial grant to open the organization. We have our headquarters here in Fort Lauderdale. We own the building and the surrounding property, and we're very happy to have all that going for us, except that we have 22 parking spaces, and we seldom fill more than three at a time. So we'd like to have more employees. If you know anybody who wants to work for free, they should give us a call. But the basic idea of the James Randi Educational Foundation is to provide an information source for the media, for scientists and researchers, for students and people who are just merely curious. They can come by at any time, or they can contact us by email or even regular mail. We actually do have a postal service here in Florida, though we're backwards in some other ways. Our governor, for example, but let's not get into that. I have an ongoing offer to anyone who wishes to come by and visit and sit around and chew the fat for a while to just simply drop by. It's best to make sure that they'll know whether I'm going to be here or not, because I do a great deal of traveling. I'm lecturing all over the world. All of that income, just so you'll understand, that I make on lectures and royalties and such, is all payable to the foundation. The foundation pays me a salary. We only have at the moment three full-time paid employees, and we have friends who come in and help us out every now and then. And, of course, we have interns that are champing to get in here in the summer, and they've been very generous with their help and very useful to us. We are constantly being sought out by the media, which makes us very happy. In many cases, they just want to have at us, but in other cases, they actually want to get information from us, and they come by. We will dub videotapes for them. We have a very, very large videotape library, which is now being reduced down to DVDs, which will bring it down to about 1/20th of the shelf space that it presently occupies, though the videotapes themselves will be sort of archived. They are not eternal, while DVDs are much more permanent. We're getting that done gradually over a period of time. But we have this vast video library, which will be a very, very valuable source of information in years to come when people want to look back on this generation and find out how silly they were when it comes to the paranormal, the supernatural, and the occult.
It's kind of funny.
That's the James Randi Educational Foundation.
It's kind of funny that you mentioned the future generations, because Robin was doing some research over on the website, and she mentioned that there's a book that you recommended back from the 1800s on how crowds react to situations.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Charles McKay's book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, because you can look at that and you can see that all you have to do is just change some of the language very slightly and change the dates and the actual subject. We don't know about the South Sea bubble now, for example, but you could have the Enron scandal. You could put it right in there and just change the exact subjects of discussion. You'd find out these things have all happened before.
And that's always fascinating. And it's great that you're putting some of that stuff on DVD, because often visual media gets degraded and lost over time.
Oh, yes, indeed. And it means that it's available. We have most of the performances of Uri Geller, for example, and in many of them you can catch them if you're swift enough at it. Get the little plug there for swift. if you're fast enough, you can see what he's doing, and you can see that what he's doing are perfectly ordinary conjuring tricks.
Yeah. You know, and you recently wrote an article in Skeptical Inquiry. I just got into my mailbox, actually, I think yesterday, on the fakers and innocents that you get for the $1 million challenge, which I don't think we brought up just yet. But you actually have an offer out for anybody to prove a paranormal activity that they can actually replicate under scientific observation, and then you'll give them
$1 million. Well, they don't even have to replicate it. They don't even really have to replicate it. At least it's a case of them being able to establish that it exists, and they have to do that under, as we say, proper observing conditions. They can't just give us anecdotal stories about what people say happened under given circumstances. But there are hundreds of claimants for the $1 million prize that have accumulated. We've got a vast filing cabinet down here, which is just incredibly jammed with people who have applied and have actually filled out the application form, which is available on our website. The website? Oh, yes. Funny you should ask. www.randi, that's R-A-N-D-I, .org. And if you look in there, you'll find something you can click on where you'll be able to see the $1 million challenge. Now, the $1 million challenge used to be a $10,000. At first, it was a $1,000 offer way back in 1968 when I started it.
Well, inflation, you know.
Yeah, well, yes, it's grown, to say the least, and so have I. But back in 1968, I offered $1,000 to any psychic could do what they said they actually could do, and I didn't get any takers back then. I increased it, personally to $10,000 at a certain point, and it was that way for many years. And then people were pointing out, gee, $10,000 is not all that much. I couldn't afford to raise it above that, so when I started the foundation here, we merely started to ask for pledges from people in increments of $1,000, and we got over $100,000 from 13 different countries, and I've forgotten about 105 or 106 people or so who pledged that. Then this millionaire chap came along and said, hey, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $1 million, and then you'll have $1 million in actual cash and in bonds, actually negotiable bonds, that you can offer. So I thought about that for a long time, like 20 seconds, and decided that I would agree to that. And he put that money in our hands, and it's in with Goldman Sachs now, well invested, and it makes a certain amount of money for us every year. We take the interest off the top of it periodically, and that helps to run the foundation.
Well, actually, it was really great for you to give that background, because a lot of people always ask, you know, does the money actually exist?
And oh, yes. Well, you get the grubbies out there. The grubbies are the people that I've used that term to designate them long. Well, these are the people who are so offended by the fact that I'm actually putting my money where my mouth is that they will come up with all kinds of excuses. We have an FAQ section on our webpage.
It's very comprehensive.
It is, right? It has to be. It has to be. There's no question about it. Robin, when you should see the stuff that comes in here, and it's so nice just to be able to give them that address that they can go to have their questions answered. That doesn't stop them, but at least it makes them pause for a while, and I get time to have lunch. But they say there is no money. Well, we can certainly prove that. All they have to do is get in touch with us. The instructions are right there. And no one has ever done that. That's astonishing. All they do is get in touch with us by phone, or by fax, or by email, and we will send them the documentary proof. But they won't do it. They just simply don't want to know the truth about it. We can show them that the account exists. It's called the James Randi Educational Foundation Pledge Trust. It's titled that way. It can't be used for any other reason. We can't draw from it except to take the interest off the top. It must remain at $1 million according to the rules that we hold this fund under. So it's there. Then the other people say, oh, it's been won many times that Randi wouldn't give them the prize. That can't be done by law, because I have committed myself on behalf of the James Randi Educational Foundation to pay that money. I'm legally committed to do it. And if I were to try to refuse to do that, then, of course, people could have at me, and they could sue me very successfully.
Well, and it's held by the reputable firm of Goldman Sachs.
Yes, that's true. And, of course, people write them all the time. They're very amused. They want to know the account number, you see, to make sure so they can try to follow up on it. I don't think we're ready to give that information, but we will send out documentation from Goldman Sachs. We simply take out the account number so that nothing, no fiddling about, can be done with that. And it can't be used for any other purpose, any nefarious purpose that we wouldn't approve of. But we will send you the documentation. But no one has ever asked for it in all the years that he's been there. They prefer not to know.
That's very surprising.
Well, you kind of hint at probably the reason why in that article that you wrote this past month, the Fakers and Innocents article. It seems like most of the folks that come to try to claim the prize are either
there.
Really, really innocent-minded folks that truly believe something that they just don't have a reason to believe, and they either walk in the door or they write you a letter. Or they're people who are actually fakers that try to win the prize in some form of con. They don't want to know the reality of the paperwork. They just want to prove somehow that they won the prize and you didn't give them the money. That well establishes their con even moving forward.
Very true. Very true. Now, I must say by far the greatest majority, I mean a good 98% of these people are innocently self-deluded, the people that apply for the prize, that is. The professionals never come anywhere near us. John Edward, for example, you may remember from television, he used to do Crossing Over,
right,
and is now holding forth in Australia, I'm told, and making millions from the naive folks out there who are grieving, and he's one of the vultures that I refer to from time to time, looking for the weak and the vulnerable and the grieving. And we sent him a specific letter offering him the $1 million prize, and we heard back from his press agent, and the letter, the entire letter read, "Dear sirs, Mr. Edward does not respond to criticism. Yours truly," and the man signed it.
Wow.
That was it. Now, I use that when a traffic cop stops me for going over the speed limit. I just say, "Officer, my name is James Randi, and I don't respond to criticism." It doesn't seem to work very well, mind you, but I thought I'd try the Edward method. But that's how simple this thing is. That's what people do. They simply refuse to take any note of it. And, of course, I don't think John Edward needs $1 million. He's got that many times over.
Okay, so does he fall under the category of, do you feel that he's doing it for his financial gain, or do you feel that he really believes that he has the power to speak to these people? I think people are drawn to him because he is so convincing and seems to be so empathetic to their plight. I mean, I did see him on television just recently. He was on a television show on CNBC, and he was talking about something, and he has that sincere face. If he doesn't believe it, he's really got his act down, because you just feel that he really believes it.
Yeah, well, of course, he's a good actor. He's got something that's going for him that makes him millions of dollars, so he's going to be good at it, or he wouldn't be in the business for very long. But I always say, look, a man doesn't pick up a violin who's never had a violin in his hand before and play Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto by accident. He has to know what he's doing. And John Edward isn't fooling himself at all. He knows exactly what he's doing. It's a thing called cold reading, referred to on our website by definitions, and it's simply there. It's something that he uses. It's a system, a method, a procedure that he goes through, and he can convince people, if they're not very observant, that he actually is bringing back messages from the dead. I'll give you a wonderful example of that. I have in our library here a bit of tape which shows conclusively how foolish people are to believe this sort of thing and how naive they can be. He's standing in front of an audience, a studio audience, and there's a middle-aged, maybe a little more than middle-aged couple sitting in the audience, and the gentleman is in tears, and he tells John Edward that he wants to contact the spirit of his deceased father. Okay? We know that. Then he sits there, and Edward gives him a reading. Now, in the first 50 seconds exactly of this reading, Edward gives him 22 facts that he's guessing at. Things like, I see the transportation industry here. There's a bus moving forward. A few things like this. And the man sits there shaking his head from side to side and saying audibly, no, 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 all the way through. But only three facts, three of those 22 guesses, the man answers yes to. And what are those three? A, this is an older man. Well, your father's got to be older than you. There's no getting around that, you see.
Right.
There's a younger man connected with the older man. Yes, the man sitting in the chair. The third thing is, the elderly man is deceased. Now, we already knew all those three things before we started. But when John Edward gives those, the man is smiling and nodding when he says these three things. At the end of this 50 seconds of rapid-fire guessing, the man turns to his wife and says, he's made contact.
Oh, man.
Oh.
You know, That's
the most incredible thing, that John Edward has been wrong all the way through the reading, and that's proof to the man that he's made contact. Another one, very quickly. A woman is interviewed backstage on the John Edward program, and the off-screen commentator asks her, he says, "Are you convinced that John Edward contacted the spirit of your deceased mother?" And the woman is bubbling over. She says, "Oh, yes, absolutely. No question of it. What was it that convinced you that you were in touch with your mother?" "Well, I'll tell you what it was. It was this one thing. John Edward said that my mother is very outgoing and cheery and bubbly and laughing and loud-voiced. And you know, in her real life, she wasn't like that at all. She was very mousy and quiet and very, very timid. I'm so glad that now that she's in heaven, she's changed her character."
Wow.
So in other words, this is another case of where Edward was wrong on everything, and that's proof to this woman that he's made contact.
Oh my!
Because that's what she wants to be true. You see?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what it comes down to. And you know, that's always my question. When you have some of these folks that obviously, at least in my opinion, they look like they're fakers. And even on some of the non entertainment, big entertainment, I would call like John Edwards a big entertainment guy. He's on TV, and or at least he's not here anymore. Maybe in Australia. But then you actually have folks that go out and push an agenda, and they're very intelligent about it, and they have conferences and speakers, and they bring in scientists, and you look at these folks, like the nexus that they've started to bring between ufology and some of the religious beliefs. I don't know if you've heard about that recently, but it's been upcropping a little more than it has been in the past, where they have these, well, it's actually Satan that's causing the UFO phenomenon, and this is a really big hot topic now, I guess, in ufology. And these guys, they bring out scientists and folks that, well, I would think, well, obviously they know better, but they speak so convincingly, it just boggles my mind. It's like, do they actually believe what they're saying? Because there is a monetary element to it. You know, they do actually make money by writing books and going to these conferences and charging $100 a person or whatever they do.
And they
just are so pound the fist on the table convincing about it, and they actually have credentials on top of it. And
but remember, some of these scientists are really convinced. You know, they can be cardiac surgeons, for example, and still be convinced that UFOs exist and that they've seen them themselves. Their specialty doesn't allow them to have interest in other fields or knowledge or expertise in other fields. Some of these people are convinced. You'd be surprised how many of these academics who appear at these conferences and such are really sincere believers in this sort of thing. They can't prove it, but they prefer that to be true. And of course, the promoters of these conferences wave them around. This man's a PhD from Harvard. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I look at some of those credentials that the folks have that speak, and I'm just blown away sometimes. Like people that are ex NASA, you know, employees that have PhDs in rocket science, you know, you look at that and it just amazes me the bizarre concepts that they grab onto that there is no proof for, but they just are convinced that there's some conspiracy, like some facts are withheld. They believe.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Somehow,
the conspiracy theorists are very, very big out there. They're the people who write me more than anything. Anything that happens, Terry Schiavo, Iran, anything, or Iraq, or any of these things, it's all a conspiracy. It's some fiendish agency, usually the CIA or the FBI, out there that's working these things on us. Now, I have some doubts about the CIA and the FBI. We all do. We've shown in the past that they aren't always dependable. But hey, everything isn't a conspiracy.
Yeah, well, it can't be. You know, if you've ever been a project manager on a project, no matter how big or small it is, you know how hard it is just to get 10 or 15, 20 people to do the same thing that's simple. I mean, a simple instruction, let alone some big interwoven multi-corporation 1,000-person conspiracy, while at the same time keeping it secret, and yet it's a well-oiled machine like some ballet that's being, you know, being conducted out in the world at a global scale. And it always amazes me that people can believe that can happen when they see in their own houses how hard it is to control their children, their own family, their friends, you know, in just small environments. It just always baffles me.
How true.
if they were that coordinated, then every company would never have their stock go down. It's just,
yeah, can you imagine? Yeah, I'd invest in that company.
So before we started the interview, you were talking a little bit about some of your feelings on the current political climate. We interviewed Tom Flynn earlier this month. From Free Inquiry, and we talked a little bit about the Christian fundamentalism, or maybe not even Christian fundamentalism, but just fundamentalism in general, and how it's been infiltrating into policy all over the country, as a matter of fact, not even at the governmental level, but even at state and local levels as well.
Well, I'm sure that Tom filled you in very well and very forcefully on his opinions on it, and I share those with him, but I'll just add that from my point of view, I'm afraid now that the fundamentalists and the creationists getting in there so deeply into the administration and affecting them so strongly, I'm afraid that we're going to have to start to look at some of the biologists and the geologists' claims and such. If any of them look for money for research that doesn't take into account that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, for example, they could come into conflict with religious beliefs. And they do come into contact with religious convictions of that nature. There are millions of people out there who believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And for them to deny that and to fly in the face of that conviction, of that of what I call a mythology, that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, would result in the fact that they just would not get funding for their projects. And anyone who offered them funding would come up against the administration. That can happen, and it might very well happen. It's happened in the past. Look at Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, in Russia, during Lenin, Stalinist days and such, the dialectical materialism was the philosophy. And Lysenko and other people decided that everything, biology, physics, chemistry, all had to fall into line with that. And when it didn't, the scientists who disagreed with them went off to the gulag. They yeah. were imprisoned for their beliefs. And it set Russian science back by at least 50 to 60 years. And it's only recovering now, beginning to recover. That could happen in this country. If it can happen in Russia, it could happen here.
Yeah, you know, that's a great example, because often people like to go pretty far back in history, but that's a very recent example. You know, the Russia only fell, you know, less than 20 years ago, maybe 20 years mm-hmm. ago now. It always makes me wonder, though, when you look at the population in general, and you just go and you talk to people on the street in general, even if they are hardcore conservatives, I don't get the sense that most people, maybe 90%, are as extreme as some of the policies that are being put forth. It seems that it's a vote grab. It seems that the administration realizes that the people that control the money, and the churches make a lot of money, and the people that filter that money to the political group play to that just for the cash. And
oh, yeah, there's no question of it.
Because the problem I have, they've played upon the one sacred cow that even in the United States, people have a hard time talking openly about, and that's religion, where even the conservatives I know of that roll their eyes when I bring up things like the creationist agenda, like, oh, yeah, but you know that that's all BS. Well, I know that it's BS and you know that it's BS, but you're willing to sit there and let it slide because you're not willing to stand up against your own party. You're not willing to stand up against your own people that you go to church with, that one person out of every 20 that you might know. You're not willing to stand up to that because you think that somehow that will deteriorate your entire belief system.
That's absolutely correct. But, you know, we have a conference coming up, a JRF conference. It's called The Amazing Meeting every year. And in January, we're going to have not only Murray Gell-Mann, the Nobel laureate, as our keynote speaker, but a lot of other luminous people in the field. And the subject that we're approaching this coming year is the science in politics and the politics of science. And what we mean by that is that science is being bashed left and right politically by the administration all over the world, as a matter of fact, not just in this country alone, believe me. And the other fact is that scientists have to submit themselves to political pressures by not saying certain things and not making certain declarations and announcing certain discoveries because they just aren't politically correct. And we've got a raft of speakers who are going to attack this subject, and I'm sure it's going to be a hot and heavy Navy session in Las Vegas in January. So if you get to our website, you'll find out all about that.
Great. Yeah, we need to get some press passes to that next meeting so we can go in and talk to you and some other folks.
Press passes? Sure. Give us a call.
Well, I know that you have to get out of here so you can make another meeting.
Yep.
But Thank you so much for your time.
It was great having you on, and maybe we can have you back in the next couple weeks again to talk a little bit about the creationist agenda. We're going to have a series of shows just about that alone.
Sure, we'll do that. But next time, I hope you folks won't talk so much. My goodness, I didn't get a word in edgewise.
Great.
Well, you've been very patient with me, and I thank you.
No problem at all. We like to listen to our guests. So it was great talking to you.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
Great.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Join our discussion forums at www.skepticality.com. Leave feedback by email at feedback@skepticality.com or by phone at area code 206-888-HOAX. That's 206-888-4629. This has been Skepticality. Thanks for listening.
Now, one, two, three.